Welcome to the International Connection. Today we continue our interview with Lyndon LaRouche from his jail cell in Alexandria, Virginia.
All right, Mr. LaRouche, we ended off with describing Noam Chomsky as actually an Aquarian. Can you give the metaphysical intellectual currents that lead into that classification?
Well, it's a very old one. Civilization, as Friedrich Schiller in his famous lecture on history at the University of Jena, divided all Western civilization between two currents, principal currents. One which is whose prototype might be the Lycurgan constitution of the Spartan slave society, the opposite being the republican form of constitutional law typified by the work of Solon of Athens. The Aquarian format, the Aquarian matrix, while it comes out of the ancient Dravidian, so-called Harappan civilizations of pre-Aryan India, and comes up in the Ishtar, Astarte cults of the Middle East, essentially in Western European civilization, is a reflection of this long continuity of the Lycurgan Delphic model. Whereas we who represent, say, the Augustinian heritage, represent the, in that sense, the model of Solon and Socrates, in the same sense that Augustine defined the distinctions between the Socratic and Christian point of view.
All right, now the IMF's policies of austerity conditions, limited conditionalities, is that the phrase?
Or whatever they want to call them. They do call them various things.
Yeah, now that is, fits in, that motive fits in with the Spartan model.
Right. The idea that society is ruled by an oligarchy which is usually composed of families, sometimes in some cases mixed with a priest caste, as the Middle Eastern Magi, for example, typify that, or the Chaldeans before them, and ruling society in the model suggested by the gods of Olympus, a group of families made of mortal individuals, but families deemed to be more or less immortal, as a collection of common and conflicting purposes, sometimes putting daggers in each other's backs, but nonetheless ruling society and keeping a social order based on rule by the oligarchs of Olympus, and keeping all the other fellows down. Imperial systems are part of that.
Okay, in light of what you just said, could you talk about the Fondi? I've read your descriptions of it. I understand in a way, but let's review what the Fondo, or I don't know which one's the plural word.
Fondo is the singular. The model was based, the Fondo was a creation essentially of Venice in its modern form, and is associated more broadly with the institution of the Lombard banking, or the financial interest behind Lombard banking.
Yeah, that was banking. That was an area, region in the Mediterranean.
Right. This actually comes out of Phoenician or Canaanite traditions, but it's in the Roman form. The Fondo is based on the model of the patria familias under Roman law, in which the difficult thing that some people have in understanding the Fondo is they assume that the Fondo, which is a family financial institution, essentially, is a form of corporation in which stock is owned by the members, or partnerships are owned by the members of the family. It's rather not the case. In point of fact, in the true Fondo, all of the property and all rights are embodied in the Fondo as a personality, as a corporate personality, with respect to which the members of the family are simply appendages.
Well, what is that corporate? Is that money? It's the medium of money itself?
It's all kinds of wealth combined together. You take all the assets of an extended family of wealth.
Yeah.
Pool all the assets in a corporate fashion. Put them under a common management. Pick executive officers for the management who may or may not be members of the family. Then this corporation so formed becomes the arbiter with like powers in life of death and death, like that of the Roman pater familias,
yes,
over all the members of the family. So the corporation decides which member of the family as an heir is going to inherit what, how much, and how long they can keep it. The power to disown the member of the family. The power to adopt a new member into the family from outside the family, biological family, that sort of thing.
Well, it's kind of like a majority concept.
No, it's not majority. It's actually the corporation has a continuity. The Fondo implicitly is a corporation soul which has the power of life or death over its members. Not by majority rule, but simply by the... It's a kind of a monarchy.
Yeah, preserve just for the sake of preserving the notion of that what they own is valuable.
Preserving the family as a force. It's more than ownership. It's more than property. It's preserving the family as a force.
It's biological.
That's right. That is putting the individual, not the family as a collection of individuals, but the family per se as the individual. And the individual human being as a member of the family, adopted or biological, merely as an appendage of the family. For example, like, say the royal family of some country decides that such and such an heir is not going to be king.
Yes.
Well, the royal family has the power in that country to decide that. That the member of the family has no absolute rights, no sovereign rights as an individual.
So it's the name is what they're preserving.
Essentially, or the force associated with the name.
Right, and then you have the spin-off philosophies of nominalism and symbolism, which reflect that, right?
Exactly.
I see. And that's another version of embedding yourself in sensory data.
In part, it can lead to that.
Yeah, which leads to hedonism.
What you get then is that as philosophies are presented, that the kinds of social institutions which rule society find certain philosophies and certain implicit philosophies of practice to be agreeable to those social institutions and others not. So that we have this between social forms and ideas for practice, we have a converging sort of tendency for practice. So what has happened in the sense of, if one says, the success of Solon's and Socrates' tradition and heritage through Christianity, Christian civilization, we have this rising civilization, this unique and precious phenomenon of Western civilization, which has fostered scientific and technological progress despite all the ups and downs and horrible things that have been done by this civilization at various points in various ways.
Yes.
Now, someone comes along and says, we don't like this. And we particularly don't like what happened in the Golden Renaissance, as John Ruskin and his company said in the English language, for example, back during the 19th century, or as Dostoevsky and Nietzsche and Burckhardt and so forth also said.
Yes.
And these fellows said, well, how do we get rid of this thing which was called the ideas of 1789? Which actually means two quite different things. One means the Cartesian Enlightenment. The other thing means the American Revolution. They're quite opposite things. But
yes.
How do we get rid of this commitment to the constitutional republican form of society? How do we get rid of natural law? How do we get rid of the commitment to the fostering of technological and scientific progress for the benefit of the development of each and all individuals? Let's say we have to have a... It just can't crush these governments that keep springing up as long as these ideas prevail. What we have to do is eradicate the influence of these ideas. So they say, let's have a cultural paradigm shift which eradicates the Christian Socratic tradition. And it went through various forms. In the Nietzschean, the John Ruskin forms are typical. More significant than the outrightly Satanist things today in the English-speaking world are the ideas of Aleister Crowley, H.G. Wells, Bertrand Russell, and so forth, which are outright Satanism.
Yeah, now the average North American may think that they are fringe philosophies, but you maintain that the influence of Crowley is very involved in this Fondi level of oligarchic control.
In the English-speaking world, very much so. For example, we have a problem in New York. A great embarrassment to the Episcopal Church, to the Anglican Church as a whole in North America, in the Diocese of New York City, that Bishop Paul Moore of that diocese is the sponsor of a leading Crowleyite organization, the Lucis Trust, formerly known, created early in this century as the Lucifer Press.
Yes.
Which is when Crowley was controlling the Theosophists. He had a magazine in Vienna called Lucifer, which was a Nietzschean sort of thing, the worship of Satan in the name of Lucifer. And this became in the 1920s, the Lucis Trust of London and New York. And the Lucis Trust is the center of organizing of Satanism in the United States today, and has some very influential Americans associated with it. So this is a very powerful minority faction within the Anglo-American liberal establishment.
All right, now to go back to the Fondi, this dedication or commitment to the corporate entity means that they would not hesitate to assassinate, murder their own brother, sister, father, mother.
This is the Dionysian concept, actually.
Dionysian concept.
Yeah, the cult of Dionysius, the Phrygian cult of Dionysius, which branch of the Sibylline cult.
Yes.
Which recruited young people from the cities to go back and murder their siblings and parents in the cities.
That were not following the plan of the Fondi.
This was the way of bringing down the cities. This was the we find this in Hesiod. Huh?
Yes.
This hostility to the city state, the Republican city state of Ionia, and of course the Athenian tradition was very much influenced by the Ionian one.
Yes.
So the Dionysian cult was directed against the Ionian city state republic form. And one of the weapons was the cult of Dionysius, which would draw youth from these cities into what we would call today something like the rock sex counterculture. And they would go off and have these orgies of dancing and intoxicants, including drugs, get themselves all whipped up in condition, become rather satanic, and then obey the orders of the cult and go back and murder their parents. We might say like the Bottomeinoff gang. Something of that sort.
Yeah, murder their own parents. But the thing I was talking about is that the average citizen probably would find it hard to imagine the ruthlessness of the Fondi to kill their own members of the family.
Oh, they do it commonly. So-and-so is a problem.
So, yeah, they don't...
Well, they usually prefer to kill members of other families. It's much more sporting. Like the Venetian Orphic Mysteries, which they act out with blindfolds at night, where the bravos of Venice used to go out under the cover of darkness and behind a mask do that which has been prohibited by daylight.
Yes. All right, so we established how the Fondi are ruthless, and therefore it's no problem for them to set up assassinations of major leaders, political leaders, business leaders, I mean, if they would kill their own kind.
Because take the case of Barbara Marx Hubbard, who's written a book which is sort of the underground Bible of the whole section of the Satanist movement in the United States, and to some degree, I presume, in Canada. She advocates that there's a quarter of the population, which really we would call Christians and Jews, who ought to be exterminated, and avows herself and her kind to be the people on the pale horse who will go through society and purge it of this lower quarter.
Of course, she advocates murdering Christians? She wouldn't say that correctly.
Well, you read the book. She advocates murdering a certain quarter, lower, one-fourth of the population.
For what reason?
Well, she, with all kinds of this interferes with her conception of what mankind should be, and she says it's her idea of a cultural paradigm shift. Go down and exterminate all those who are the bearers of these undesirable ideas.
All right. Now, have you ever had contact personal with Chomsky or Hubbard or these people who you consider
Chomsky? Yes. Chomsky's a funny fellow. We've had contact with him.
But you haven't debated him publicly.
I've offered to. He just sort of stayed away from it. Chomsky owes me something, you know. That's a story I wrote about. You may have run across.
Yes. That was something back in the 70s.
Back in the 60s. It was back in 59, 60. I was early on.
The thing you sent up to the MIT.
That's right. The thing, not indirectly. I gave it to a friend of mine who was writing the show.
Yeah.
And he took it up to MIT, and he, Chomsky and Minsky, produced the script to simulate what I said could be done. It's great fun.
But he would never admit that.
Oh, he might. You never know. Noam's a funny fellow.
All right. So, just get back on track here. Have you heard of Stephen Hawking's book, I think it's something, A Brief History of Time?
I've heard the name. I'm not familiar with the book.
All right. Well, he was one of the propagandists for the Big Bang Theory, I think, in the 60s and early 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to quote what you wrote about the Big Bang Theory. Now, Hawking has retracted that. He's not a Big Banger anymore. But let me just give you the quote you wrote, I guess, in the late 70s, early 80s. The Aristotelian view, for which the methods used by Oxford and Cambridge alike are in fact derivative, describes the universe as originating with some form of Big Bang, establishing a universe in which elementary discretenesses for example, elementary self-evident particles, are irreducible givens. Such a Big Bang universe is presumed to be consistently governed in its internal relationships by permanently fixed laws of the sort which might be comprehensively expressed by systems of algebraic equations. Now, I just thought it was interesting that Hawking is now talking about the possibility of many other dimensions and has rejected the Big Bang theory. What would you say is wrong with the Big Bang, and I wonder if it would overlap with Hawking?
No, the idea of the multidimension thing is a wrong concept. I'm familiar with that. That is a dead end, unprofitable. It's not the problem. The way to look at this is to have fun to look at. Let's go back to Newton, who's great fun on this thing.
Yes.
Newton, of course, admitted that insofar as what people call today the second law of thermodynamics or general entropy appears in his system as it does, he says that this, of course, is absurd, and no sane person would think that this is correct, the correct view of the universe as a whole. And he adds that, however, he's required to do this not because he believes it's true, but only because his choice of mathematics superimposes that impression upon the data.
Right.
So, now, the point is very, and this was taken up, of course, Newton's reference to this was taken up by Leibniz in the Leibniz-Clark Newton correspondence, the famous collection.
Yes.
The problem is a very elementary one, is that if you construct a linear model, which all, say, formal Euclidean or Cartesian analysis are, axiomatically, then you must present mathematically an image of the universe which is what they call entropic, which means that if you accept that consistently, as Aristotle did in his own way, then you are compelled to presume that the universe was created by some big bang and that there were no laws prior to that point. And that solves your problem. See, no laws existed, laws were created with the big bang, and therefore, since you cannot axiomatically go before the big bang, the universe is running down consistently, and the laws are quite linear and quite neat from there on in.
Right. Now, the new science of chaos, they call it.
Right, same thing.
That's fitting in with that paradigm.
Same thing. The only alternate to that, if any interesting in astronomy, of course, was the line which is taken by Hoyle in this Hoyle's pulsating universe, that it doesn't either, it sort of bangs and then unbangs.
Yes.
The pulsating universe. It's all nonsense. The universe is directed. The universe is actually negentropic, and that's the problem these fellows have, and that's where this new dimension thing, as you indicate, I know of the thing, I don't know it in Hawking's connection, that where that breaks down. Is that the universe is inherently negentropic. That is, where it's constantly going to higher states. But that's a big subject in itself.
Right. Now, so if Hawking fits into this British Royal Society paradigm, this Aristotelian view, then would you suggest that the promotion of Hawking in all the media over the past year is an operation of the oligarchic British intelligence group?
In a sense, it's like garment fads. It's like new styles and hats and shoes and clothing. The hemlines go up and the hemlines go down.
Yes.
And in the science community, which is to a large degree more of a religious cult than science, at least in the politics of the publish business and the referee system and whatnot.
Yes.
That they have to have these sort of things to talk about. And for example, we had this business about the nuclear freeze, or this horrible thing that's going to happen, nuclear winter, which is cooked up as a propaganda piece on a Soviet computer, run through some complicit fellows in the West, and it was all over the press for about a year. Then we had the greenhouse effect, which has been kicking around for a while, never existed. They had and also the ozone hole over the Antarctic, how all kinds of things were causing this. They had this recent conference on meteorology, and the greenhouse effect, the data showed it doesn't exist. And the ozone hole, which they'd been studying for some months earlier, had suddenly closed up and disappeared.
That was announced at the conference.
This was one of the disturbing things at the conference. People were going to present theories of why the ozone hole was expanding and going to destroy the entire planet. And by the time someone said, well, we couldn't take it off the agenda, it wasn't there anymore, you know. And the greenhouse effect wasn't there. There are meteorological problems, such as which are associated with the drought pattern, the aridity, the widening of the aridity belt. But this is associated actually not with a simple heating phenomenon, which is not there. What it's associated with is a weather instability pattern. increasing instability. For example, we're going to have a great deal of food loss in Canada and the United States because of warmth during part of the winter season, which encouraged certain crops to begin growing, and then the sudden Arctic freeze in late January, the beginning of February, which came down, or beginning of February, which destroyed this. Now, that's going to cause food shortage. We have areas of the world where we don't have an absolute shortage of rainfall, but you have alternating periods of drought, extended periods of drought, with torrential deluges, as we had in, say, Bangladesh last year, in the, following the previous year's monsoon problem. Then we had the same thing in Sudan this past year, the torrential deluge where they got about 1 year's rainfall delivered that year, but all in 2 days. So these extremes, so there are problems, but the general kind of thing that becomes popularized as science feature feds in the newspapers, most of this is usually garbage, but I suppose they have to keep coming out with something new.
Yes.
Like hemlines.
Now, you relate the weather instability to the destroying of the Amazon forest and that as a result of IMF conditionalities on those Ibero-American countries.
Not just that, there are other things. For example, there's an entire island in Indonesia, which Japan just stripped in a similar way. That sort of thing. We've been working on this, as you know, for, well, now 15 years on this particular problem.
Who's been working on this?
I have.
Yes. So that's, now we come into the next quote, which is why you recommend moving from nuclear to fusion technology. Is it fusion?
Yeah, well, both. It was second generation fusion, and I'm currently looking a little bit further to the future since I see the second generation of fusion as scientifically now clearly in sight. I'm looking at, let's look at the next one, matter-antimatter reaction, which involves some very interesting things. And I feel like I like to keep going ahead to new frontiers beyond
the
ones I've already explored.
All right, here's a quote written in the early 80s. Although long-term economic growth must be based on vertical advances in technology, for the next 2 decades, we can inaugurate a great expansion in total and per capita production of wealth globally, beginning with the horizontal application of current plus emerging state-of-the-art high technologies exported from industrialized into developing nations. This horizontally based expansion must be used as the material basis for developing adequate potentials for vertical expansion. Could you elaborate just a bit on that, the vertical and the horizontal?
For example, productivity and potential population density, which includes the potential level of material existence of populations, longevity and so forth, correlates with increases in the quantity, one may say for first approximation, the quantity of energy available per capita and per hectare. So therefore, if we can produce very rapidly a large amount of energy, usable energy, and distribute it, we have the means for increasing the productivity of labor and the potential population density in many parts of the planet. With that, we can use existing capital goods technology, state-of-the-art sort of things, which already exist, and just pump them out in proliferation, expanding our capital goods, machine tool-related industry, for that purpose. Thus, we can get very quickly a very significant increase in the productivity of the planet. That then gives, in turn, the means for a rapid expansion on that broadened base of the advanced machine tool industry. So when I say vertical industry, I mean essentially the ratio of producers' goods production to consumer goods production.
All right. Now, in general, the alienation supposedly in the West is too much work, too hard, too much consumption. The technologies are creating a lot of disservices and side effects, say, for example, in the medicine, the medical drugs. What do you say to that kind of criticism of technological expansion?
You got two problems. You got one problem, the idea, the opposition to scientific progress, the idea to hard work, at least if it's meaningful hard work, is absurd. That's how the human race survives, is by scientific progress and hard work.
But what about the stress factor of the computer environment causing such a speed up?
Oh, the computer is the problem. Digital computers, because they are what they are, to the degree the human mind is, which is not digital, is subordinated to digital processes.
Yes.
This is dehumanizing and is stressful in that sense. You can get the same effect with Go, which I observed some years ago and started to learn the game of Go, and found that if I concentrated on playing Go over a couple of days, say on a vacation, and for long hours each day, I began to rearrange the faces of my friends in Go patterns, and I said, no more of this. And I saw a similar phenomenon, of course, among computer programmers and people who work, that they would tend to get in that kind of very strange mentality. I don't want to do that to human beings.
Right, well, that's partly what McLuhan talked about, is the effect of the technology on one's psyche.
That's right. So,
you would agree with that part?
Much, yeah, sure. You have to think, when you're using a different kind of technology, you have to think about the way in which you use it and the effect of the way in which you use it upon the human being who's using it. It's just like constructing a house. Well, I suppose these days, with prices as they are and circumstances they are, people are very happy to have any kind of a decent house. But in a good, well-ordered society, people want beauty, a sense of beauty, kinesthetic in terms of movement, acoustically, visually. We could build that sort of thing, and therefore people should have beautiful, aesthetic places to live as well as ones which are merely functional. Yes, we must consider that sort of thing.
Right. Now, so... Basically, when you talk about technology, you're talking about energy potential, the basic energy-producing technologies as the real development evolution of the universe. I mean, computers, they don't make energy. They're part of the energy system, and the excessive... How would you organize the use of computers if it is causing stress?
I have two things. First of all, a computer, the way we're using it, is not so much the problem of the computer as such. So there are problems which got me out of the field years ago. I saw they were incurable.
Yes.
I said, I'll take my professional activities elsewhere until society comes around and realizes need to correct these mistakes. But the computer is not a productive instrument. It is it is essentially a means of administration and control. It is actually a labor-saving device of administration and production control.
Yes.
And we should use it that way. What we're doing is we're creating paperwork, in effect, paperwork procedures for computers. We're allowing the amount of computer potential to be used, or to expand the amount of nonsense supplied to computers to use them up to the level of their potential, rather than saying what should society be doing and use the computer as a labor-saving device. It's wrong. The problem is it's changes in nature and increases a man's power to control nature per capita, which is the measure of productivity. Not this. This is a useful helping device, if it's used as a helping device.
And so the whole mythology of moving into a post-industrial information society is this fetishizing and obsessiveness, use and overuse of the computer world then.
Well, there's a fascist element to it.
Fascist, or I'm saying fetishist?
They're both.
Yeah.
There's a relationship between the two. Fascism essentially is the elimination of reality and its substitution with a rather nasty symbology. Now, this is why I fought the Wiener's information theory on, because it contained that implication, that absurdity. And in his book, Following His Cybernetics, His Human Use of Human Beings, where he pronounced himself a socialist, he also pronounced himself, in my view, a bit of a fascist.
Yeah.
With this kind of information theory. It's destructive. It's terrible. Awful stuff. People aren't eating. We have a lower standard of living than we had 20 years ago. If you use physical market basket standards, we're now proceeding to kill old people because we can't afford to meet the pensions and the medical care. What Hitler had done, if we found that on Hitler's roster, which we could have, we'd say he was a terrible fellow for doing that sort of thing, but now we're doing it.
Yes.
So we've got our values wrong. We are in the worldwide food charters. This year, cereals, grains, so on, will probably the production will reach about 60% at best, the minimal requirement for the human population as a whole, and yet the international institutions and national agricultural institutions and others are saying we must set aside more land, which is mass murder.
All right, now that's a very good topic. I have some information on that. Let's end today's interview on that point, and we'll continue next week from that area of thought. I've been speaking with Lyndon LaRouche in Alexandria, Virginia. That's the International Connection for this week. I'm Bob Marshall for CKLN. We'll be back next Sunday at 10 o'clock in the morning.